Coiled Spring, Episode 7. Hello and welcome to The Coiled Spring, the podcast with potential. I'm your host, Matthew Petty, and this episode I'm pleased to welcome back Kristen McGorry, who was my guest on the first episode of The Coiled Spring all the way back in September 2012, if you can remember that far. And I say this episode, I keep wanting to say this week, but let's be reasonable, that's just setting myself up for failure. This month sounds too much like a promise, let's just stick with episode for now and see where that gets us, okay? Anyway, Kristen has just cast her new play, The Seance, and The Coiled Spring is very pleased to present a preview of this new piece performed by the playwright and one of her most well-respected colleagues in the theatre world. In addition to that, I review Pinwheel's cookies. Yeah, they're delicious and all, but they're not so special. That segment is becoming less like Matthew reviews a seminal American cultural artefact and more like Matthew records himself eating biscuits. A noble endeavour, to be sure, but not necessarily what I was waiting for. All this and more awaits in the
Coiled Spring.
So I'm here once again with my good friend Kristen McGorry. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for inviting me back after the last time.
No, it was a wonderful start to the show. I would love to say, to be able to say that, you know, we had lots of requests for your return. Let's leave it at that. But yeah, so you're back again in the city, and you've got something that you'd like to share with us.
Yes, well, I think last time when we talked a bit about drama and our humble beginnings and where we first met and became friends, mm-hmm. just in Carlton Dramatic Society, and we talked about how I'd written a couple of plays for them, and I'm actually in the process of writing and directing the next production for them.
That's great. And so, I mean, because the last time you wrote something which was, it was The Mask of the Red Death.
That's right.
An adaptation of the Poe story.
Yeah, extremely loosely.
Or a reimagining, perhaps?
Yeah, let's call it that.
Reboot.
A reboot. Mask of the Red Death, a reboot.
With, like, teenagers and stuff.
Yeah, directed by J.J. Abrams.
Oh, God.
It's going to be a trilogy. It's going to be a trilogy.
It's going to have too much lens flare on it. And I'll have some smug Easter eggs in the credits.
Yeah.
So Mask of the Red Death. That was a huge success. That was very well received.
Yes. And obviously it was even more financially successful because the Carlton didn't have to pay rights.
Always a good thing.
Always a good thing.
We touched on the creative flexibility that can impose upon a group.
Yes.
Not having any money.
Exactly. So with that production, I got to spend it on really exciting things. Instead of having to pay rights to some dead author's family, we got to spend it on essentially making dummies.
Oh, dummies.
Yeah, mummies.
Maybe mummies. You could have, like...
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like, just a bit of a digression, it seems like in some theatre groups, especially ones without any money, it's a good idea to have sort of multi-purpose props that can be brought out.
That's true.
I know that Carlton has had at least a very good lamppost that was made out of drain pipe,
mm-hmm.
and could be configured in a number of ways, including modern, C.S. Lewis, and various other forms, but it was all basically
lamppost.
The same thing.
Great. Wasn't that he had her up the arse or whatever that line is from?
Yes, probably.
From Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh God, yes. Oh no,
he had her behind the arse.
Oh well, I'd be on the arse. Which no, that was behind the trellis.
Yes, that was. That's the other piece of scenery that has
always
played
have a trellis.
Various.
It can be trellis.
Could be anything.
It can be a divider in a room.
Yeah.
It can be a screen behind which someone gets changed.
Yeah.
Except with all the holes in it.
Yeah.
You can dangle plastic vines off it for Shakespeare.
For Shakespeare, exactly. So,
wonderful stuff.
Perfect.
Anyway, we've digressed enough. So what is this new play of yours called?
So, we discussed last time how I was really into horror, and mm-hmm. so I've really decided to branch out with this latest theatrical production, and essentially it's the spiritual sequel to Mask. quite literally.
Really? So yes. It's another horror play.
Well,
and what is it called?
It's called The Seance.
The Seance.
Yes. I decided to not think of a really smart, kind of intelligent title and just go for a title that people could go, ah, it's called The Seance because it's about a seance.
Yeah, but I think horror, or at least ghost stories. I mean, is it horror or a ghost story?
It's historical.
I'm assuming
ghost story.
Historical ghost story. So yeah. I mean, I think that kind of can be treated as something separate from horror.
Yes. It's a better class of horror.
Because apart from anything else, I can't imagine you can do torture porn live on stage with a low budget.
I don't know. I mean, you know, we could make buckets of blood. Kensington
sort of
gore.
Toss them around.
Yes.
Have people screaming. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Or we could actually torture the cast. I mean, that's the cheapest way to do it, really.
For one night only.
Yes.
We present
a different cast every night.
Every night. Because, yeah. Oh, gosh.
I think we've grossed ourselves out now, haven't we?
Oh. So what's the story behind the seance?
So, when I started researching, because I'm writing a novel as well at the moment, because I like to just have several hundred projects on the go.
Of course.
And when I started kind of researching that, I started finding out about spiritualism. And for people who don't really know what spiritualism is, it is a religion. It still is a religion.
Okay.
It was a religion that was essentially grew out of two little girls called the Fox Sisters in New York State, who were the first people to, first people to essentially say that they were able to contact spirits. And they lived in this like sort of little wooden house, and they basically conjured up this spirit who they called Mr. Splitfoot. And he kind of knocked on walls and could like answer questions, and they asked him questions, and he was the spirit of a peddler who apparently had died, been murdered in their house by somebody in the town. And yeah, essentially they created this entire religion out of something that was completely fake, which was essentially, they revealed many, many years later, was them banging an apple on a piece of string against the back of the, behind the bed.
Oh my goodness, it was someone was pulling on a string. And
the little girls were, yeah, and one of them as well could could manipulate her sort of foot so that she could sort of bang her heel on the floor without actually you couldn't actually tell that she was moving her foot.
Oh, I see.
So out of this grew this phenomenon, really.
Isn't it amazing it's amazing that a religion can build and grow even when the original stories have been shown to be complete nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, it was way too late, I suppose, by that point. And I think they didn't really kind of come forward until they were sort of, you know, in this quite old. Mm. So it really gained a momentum all of its own. And this was kind of like the mid-1800s, so like 1850s. And then out of that grew this whole kind of phenomena of talking to the dead and mediums and seances and contacting the dead.
Now, of course, communing with the ancestors has been a part of cultures throughout the ages.
It's very
true. I suppose
it's
just the latest incarnation of that, if I can borrow a phrase or a word from those things. Yeah, interesting, fascinating stuff. And so this play obviously uses spiritualism in some way.
Yes. So when I started, so the height of spiritualism really was kind of the between about the 1850s and the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of fell out of favour a little bit. And then with the First World War, with obviously an entire generation dying, it came back, it had a resurgence.
Yes.
So sort of in during the First World War and kind of up until the mid-20s. And the focus of the play is actually a real life friendship between two people, two very big historical figures of the time, who were actually friends.
Oh.
Which is Houdini, the magician or escapologist Harry Houdini,
yeah,
and the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle.
Really? They were friends with
them? They were friends, yes, because they both became friends because of their interest in spiritualism.
Now, were they practicers or just dabblers or just interested as learned men?
So Arthur Conan Doyle was an advocate of spiritualism. Okay. He completely and utterly believed in it. He believed that he'd contacted his son who died in the First World War,
yeah,
Kingsley. And he absolutely believed it 100%. No evidence to the contrary could refute him. And as you know, I'm sure you know, Arthur Conan Doyle also was responsible for the fairies at the bottom of the garden, the little girls who took the pictures of the fairies.
Yes, he was. That's
he was
right.
A very, let's be kind, he was a very believing, trustful man who wanted to believe in this phenomena. And,
yeah.
And yeah.
He was very credulous.
Credulous, exactly.
Is that the word?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Harry Houdini was, you know, an escapologist and a magician, and he started his career by using the tricks that the mediums used,
right,
and essentially sort of built a stage show around it as if it was real,
yeah,
and then became a massive, massive debunker and essentially the world's greatest medium debunker, really.
Right. Because, yes, and it seems that, I mean, at the moment we have, what's his name, James Randi.
Yes.
Who started out as a magician, tricks and sleight of hand and all that, and is now the biggest debunker of the times.
Yes, he is.
I wonder what it is about practicing this kind of, well, I mean, it's these shows, which are basically deceit, but deceit with a good cause, you know, for fun and entertainment.
Yeah.
Tricks and sleight of hand and so on. I wonder how that leads people to want to sort of disprove the dishonesty behind some of it.
I think it's because, I mean, Houdini, one of the things that Houdini said in his, you know, I mean, he's luckily for me, for this play, there's an incredible amount of source material of his own letters, his letters, yes, to Conan Doyle. And he, you know, he wrote several books. He wrote a book called The Magician Amongst the Spirits,
okay,
which was about his experience of kind of debunking mediums and miracle mongers and their methods, where he exposed people like fire eaters and people who could put spikes and nails and things,
yes,
through their,
yes,
mouths. And I think for him it was very much about he saw the damage that could be done, and
right,
because these people, it's not like these people would come round to your house and go, I've got a message for you from your dead son. No, I don't want any payment. Just your happiness is enough. You know, these people were essentially making a very, very good living from defrauding people in their darkest hour. When,
yes,
you know,
and those accusations can still be aimed at,
they can,
mediums
indeed,
these days.
They can indeed.
Charlatans who prey on the bereaved.
Yes.
But still get television and newspaper deals out of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
Snack review time again. This time around, I've got something that my wife recommended. My wife, Cassie, she recommended I get these from the grocery store, and they are pinwheels, pure chocolate marshmallow cookies. Now, that's quite similar to the snowballs that I had last time, but I think these are a lot better. And I know that for a fact because they come in a packet of 12, and there's two left. So I'm going to eat them now for your pleasure. They're by Nabisco, which, of course, as you should know, is part of the Kraft Foods empire. They're made in Canada, and you know, there's the usual snack cake ingredients list, which I won't bore you with this time. But there's all sorts of stuff in there. But basically, they are ring-shaped cookies. They come in a big kind of plastic tray, each individual, and they're kind of crumbly. The chocolate is quite flaky. But here we go. So there's a ring-shaped cookie with a marshmallow coating on the top, a sort of a ring on top of that, and then the whole thing is coated in quite thick chocolate. So let's take a bite. Mmm. Yeah, that's really good. I don't know if you heard that. There was a few crumbs of chocolate fell into the tray to be retrieved later. The cookie itself is a bit cakey rather than being a crunchy cookie. And the marshmallow is much better than the snowball stuff I had before because it's actually like marshmallow rather than foam rubber soaked in glucose. The chocolate is pretty good too. It says it's... The ingredients list says it's sweet chocolate coating. So it's not, you know... Okay, it's not Cadbury's, but it's better than Hershey's. So, you know, middle ground. And it's quite thick chocolate too, so that's a good deal. And there we go, and that's pretty much it. Pinwheel cookies, quite delicious. I asked Cassie why she recommended them to me, and she said, well, she didn't really know. They're not necessarily a huge classic, but they are a standard that to be found in most American grocery stores, so it was worth a try. But I'm going to set her to work finding other classics for us to try, and we'll see what she comes up with next time. So there we go. Pinwheel, pure chocolate and marshmallow cookies. Thank you very much. So how is that all tied together into the play?
So I mean, obviously they went to, they organised and participated in quite a few seances together.
Right.
You know, Arthur Conan Doyle very much from the, he was always trying to prove to Houdini that this was the truth. He told Houdini that he thought Houdini had his own psychic powers. So Houdini had a trick many tricks where he would essentially escape from things like the mm-hmm. Chinese water torture cell, and Conan Doyle actually believed that Houdini had the power of dematerialization.
Right.
And that he was a psychic. And so he wanted Houdini to kind of admit that he had this psychic power and that they would, yeah. So,
and, sorry,
no, go on.
Was Houdini in a position to show the tricks and say, look, this is a, or was he hamstrung by his own pride to not show the secrets?
So the thing with Houdini was that he was more of an escapologist than a magician.
Yeah.
And, you know, he actually had incredible, he performed incredible physical feats.
Yeah.
So, you know, he would actually, he's not like an illusionist in that it's, you know, it's twins.
Yeah, yeah.
he would actually escape from straitjackets and from these kind of water cells. And,
yes.
Because he could pick the locks or... and so, you know, there was no real trick in that sense to what he did. The trick was more in the showmanship that he...
Right.
And I think even... I mean, there's this great story actually about because Arthur Conan Doyle's wife and the four, you know, the two couples, so Houdini and his wife and Arthur Conan Doyle and Lady Conan Doyle mm-hmm. were kind of great friends. And there's this great story that Houdini tells where they're all in a car together traveling to New York from New York, and he does the trick, you know, when you're a child, when you've got a child and you make your thumb break in half.
Oh yes.
Yeah. And he did this to Lady Conan Doyle, and she was absolutely like flabbergasted, and you know, was like, oh, he's made his thumb sort of break apart.
He can dematerialize.
Exactly. And so I suppose Houdini probably thought at that point, if they're so fooled by something that wouldn't even fool, you know, somebody older than five,
yeah,
then and I think he repeatedly told, you know, he repeatedly said to Arthur Conan Doyle, this is a trick, and
yeah.
You know, this is how these people are doing this. You're trying to do the thumb thing.
I'm trying to do the thumb thing. Well, what I'm trying to do is I can do it. I'm just trying to imagine how it's possible for someone to think that he is. I don't know. It's impossible. It's a fun looking trick to do, but
yeah.
who would actually believe it?
I know. It's incredible. I
mean, I'm just imagining Harry Houdini with his face in his palm most of the time.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I mean, that's it. And he did but you see what you want to see. And I think that's the whole point of
yes.
that's the whole point of spiritualism.
Yes.
Is that you've essentially, you know, you don't want to see the wires. You don't want to see the bits of sort of twine
and especially
with the sheet on the end.
Right. And especially, you know, when you're every male son of the village has been killed exactly. in the Great War, then everyone yeah. wants to believe that they're out there somewhere. Yes.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
you can understand that, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's incredible comfort in that, isn't there? That, you know, it's ultimately the biggest question and the human condition to is there life after death? And
yeah.
the mediums essentially were out to prove that there was.
Yes, but unfortunately they were wrong, or at least in my opinion.
Yes, well, you know, I mean, think you know, in most people's opinion.
I think so. You know, when I was talking to a bereavement counsellor about 7 years ago, I suppose, they were saying, "Yeah, you've got to go through the process, and this kind of thing actually doesn't do you any good. It can, in fact,
mm-hmm.
get in the way of the normal healing process because it's not like giving you false hope that they're going to come back or anything, but it's just, you know,
I think it's you." It's about moving on, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
not necessarily forgetting, obviously, but just...
Yeah, just...
Move on.
Exactly.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
I suppose because the seances, the Victorian seance,
mm-hmm.
was a performance... You know, it was so fantastical, and the things that some of these mediums did, you know, were so. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily fool an audience today, but they things like you know, the medium kind of dressing up as a ghost and,
mm-hmm.
and wearing kind of fluorescent paint and muslin
right.
or ectoplasm.
Yes.
You know, there was a story about a medium whose husband was a surgeon, and he surgically altered her inside so that she could expel ectoplasm out of her womb. So there's these incredible sort of potentially apocryphal stories.
That's apocryphal, I hope. It's like horrific. I mean...
Yeah, but wow. you know, I mean, that was the thing. It was all about sleight of hand and misdirection. And so, what I've tried to do with the play is essentially play upon the showmanship of it. So
yes.
it's kind of a play. There's a play within a play.
Okay.
So it's like a kind of a Victorian vaudeville. They
mm-hmm.
had these things. Called the dime museums where they had the sort of, you know, the bearded ladies. It's where kind of Barnum and
yes,
those guys
yes,
started,
yes.
you know, bearded ladies.
What are they called? Dime museums?
I think they were called the dime museums, yeah. So you would pay your dime and...
Oh, dime, yes.
Dime, yeah. And then you would go and sort of like stand and point at the conjoined twins.
The freaks, yes.
Yeah, the
yes.
freaks.
Todd Browning was his name? Todd Brown?
I don't know.
I'll edit it, but he did the...
Yeah.
The guy who did the Freaks film, yeah.
Oh, yes, of course, so yes. Yeah, so you've got this kind of cast of what essentially I'm calling the Freaks and the Soubrettes of the Dark Circus.
Okay.
And there's this, the character who was originally called Malefant.
Yeah.
Because I just loved the name.
Mm-hmm.
And then I turned to Mr. Splitfoot because I liked the fact that it had this... correlation
of
with
course.
The first, but then I've turned it back to Malefant.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Well, Splitfoot, of course,
makes him a little bit too comic, but yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it also makes me think of cloven hoofs.
Well, that, yes. I mean, it's...
And a man with cloven feet, of course,
is the divil
Pan
himself.
Or the divil.
The divil himself.
The goat of Mendes.
Yes. And so, yes, so you've got these performers who are essentially putting on a play
mm-hmm.
or giving this evening's entertainment. So they kind of introduce Houdini, and I want to have Houdini doing tricks.
Wow.
Want to involve, we're actually going to do the male, Houdini's mailbag escape. I want to have the audience involved, and we're going to do some cold reading. So do you know cold reading?
Yes, I think I know what it is, but for the benefit of the listener.
So cold reading is essentially what most mediums use. Now, I'm not going to sort of like say that every medium out there is some kind of sort of evil charlatan who's trying to sort of stiff people out of their money. I think a lot of mediums probably genuinely believe that they have psychic powers and that they are able to talk to the dead and they have spirit guides and, you know, they genuinely believe this. But the technique that a lot of mediums use is actually something called cold reading. So, and how that works is, I mean, in its most crudest sense, it's me kind of standing up and going, I sense, Matthew, that that you're a really, really caring person, but sometimes you kind of you feel like you're a bit put upon. You know, you're very creative, but you're not. You're very practical as well. You know, there's a practical part of your creativity, and essentially. Wow. Yeah, and you're really sensitive.
You've nailed it. Yeah, that's amazing.
Exactly. There's essentially these kind of 12 tenets of it which are such general statements, and they're also contradictory statements. So everybody, it's like, Matthew, you really enjoy going out in the evenings, but you also like staying at home with a good book now and again. Mm-hmm. You know, and who isn't going to say, if I say to you, you're actually really intelligent, but, you know, sometimes people underestimate how intelligent you are. No person in their right mind is going to sit there going, no, I'm actually really thick, not creative, or, you know, I'm not kind or intuitive.
Or at least they will attach onto certain bits of it and,
exactly,
and focus in, and you catch onto that and then
exactly.
draw more out. And
yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a very, very crude example of it. But, you know, the good cold readers will also kind of read body language, and they'll sort of say things, and they'll turn. So you have positive and negative hits. So a positive hit will be, I'm sitting in front of you and maybe kind of reading your palm or reading some cards, like tarot cards.
Yeah.
And I'll say, I feel like you've been on a journey, and you'll kind of like, you'll be like, you know, you won't give me anything.
Okay.
And I'll say, no, it's not a real journey. It's more like a metaphorical journey. Perhaps through you've had a period of bad health. And again, nothing. Uh-huh. So I'm like, right, that's a negative hit. Or maybe not so much health, but maybe somebody close to you has been ill recently. And suddenly, and you're like,
yes.
And so it's good cold readers, essentially... will kind of bring you along with them and make it seem like it's the process. So the process is that I'm, you know, because the spirit world is murky and dark. It's not like picking up the sort of, well, it might be picking up like a phone with Vodafone or something, but.
Oh, well, yeah. Ooh, with a or Skype. Satire,
yeah. You know, it's sometimes the messages don't come through very clearly.
Right, and you have to keep sort of. Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing that, you know, when the mediums do is that they will kind of. Most people know somebody called John, somebody's, you know, name beginning with J or K, or, you know.
Oh, John, did you know someone called John?
Yeah.
He says, be careful tomorrow.
Yeah.
Cool, all right.
Or my favourite one.
That was lucky.
Exactly, yeah, because I could have, something terrible could have happened tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
But my favourite one is like, where, I'm feeling like an older lady, and she's complaining about her legs. It's like literally applies to everybody's gran ever.
Yes. She was quite young, wasn't she? No, she was 93. Yeah, but she was young at heart. Yeah.
Young at heart. Exactly. And there's so many ways to turn. And the other thing that they do is that they almost turn it into your fault. There's
because,
a negative.
You know, I'm having to reach into your head, and
exactly,
it's all jumbled
exactly.
up inside.
Yeah. So I mean, it's an incredible skill.
Yeah.
But it's an incredibly dangerous skill. But what? So I'm going to essentially teach it to some actors and let them loose on an audience.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the thing. You are going. So yeah, you're going to actually perform an escape trick.
Yes.
Every night, live on stage.
Yes.
And do some cold reading. Now, of course, cold reading can go badly or can go well, whatever, and obviously practice will help with that. But I can't help but be concerned about the escape trick. But I suppose it's just going to be props.
Yes. Well,
you're not going to actually do an escape trick. I mean, it's not going to be an escape trick in the sense of how Houdini would have done it.
It's going to be escape trick exactly how Houdini would have done it. So you can actually buy Houdini's tricks online.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, you know. And,
okay. And special padlocks and things that you can get out of.
I think, I mean, the best ones, because that's the other thing about these things, is quite often, it's about the misdirection. So you might have the fake kind of bars that your kind of hands are bound by.
Yes.
They're the fake part and the padlock is the genuine part. So people will essentially make people focus on what you want them to focus.
Right, on the padlock.
And, you know, God, that's never going to break. Whereas, you know, there's a microscopic sort of cut between the metal. I mean, it's all about showing people what you want them to see and pushing them down a path. And that's exactly what a seance was.
And of course, yes, when people go to see a magic show or something like that, they want to be entertained and they want to be dazzled.
Exactly.
And when people go to a seance, they want to hear or see something.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, you will...
stuff.
It's about the show. And you don't want to... You don't really want to see the wizard behind the curtain.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
So we've got a real treat now, because we're going to do a reading from the play. It'll be the first time that Kristen and I have read something together since, goodness knows, well... They came from Woking.
Oh.
The science fiction comedy set in...
Woking.
In Woking, strangely enough. Well, I remember just a little digression here. I remember when I invited my colleagues that I was working with at the time to see the play.
Yeah.
And I think one of them went to Woking.
afterwards?
No, because they thought the play was in Woking. It was actually performed in Wimbledon. And I said, it's in Wimbledon, but the play is called They Came From Woking. And they couldn't understand that you could have the name of a place in a play without that play actually being in that place.
Gosh, that's amazing. Where did you work?
London Underground, but I don't want to... but don't feel unsafe about riding the London Underground just because of that.
Well, they're literally on rails, so...
They are, that's true. They can't sort of wander off. Anyway, So yes, it's a big treat. We're going to read a scene from the play. And so, Kristen, what is this scene about?
So this is the scene where the wives of Lady Conan Doyle and Bess Houdini leave the two great men alone to talk before the séance. This scene probably best sets out their opposing positions.
Okay.
At this point, you know, obviously, as the play progresses, it becomes more difficult for their opposing views to remain harmonious.
Yes.
But now they're kind of good friends talking about their real sort of love and interest, which is spiritualism.
And so these characters, we have Harry Houdini, who's obviously the famous escapologist, is that a word?
Magician, yeah, whatever.
And he was American, right?
No, he was Hungarian. Yes, okay. He was an American immigrant, so he came to America when he was young.
And then Arthur Conan Doyle, of course, the famous Scottish author. The point I'm getting at is that... Houdini probably had a Hungarian accent, did he?
I've not heard him speak. That's the next thing I want to do. But I think he probably would have had an American accent because he was adopted really as one of their own.
Right.
And I think on his birth certificate or his citizenship, it says that he was born in like Idaho
Ohio. Okay. And then of course Arthur Conan Doyle, Scottish.
Yes.
But in this reading, we're not going to try and attempt accents.
No, we're going to do it with our received pronunciation.
Received.
Our normal speaking voices.
Absolutely, the way we always talk.
Yes.
Because
regularly.
We might be able to teach actors how to do magic tricks.
Yes.
But teaching them how to speak with a different accent is just asking a little bit too much.
It is asking a little bit too much, yes.
Especially at this hour.
Well, good luck. I mean, my American accent is probably better than my Scottish accent. I think that's harder to do. So
Well, I have been living in California since 2008, but I'm not I'm not going there. Especially, I'm not going to speak in a Scottish accent just because I've been living in California. That'd be strange.
I would love you to do Conan Doyle as a surf California surf dude, though. I think that would be... No.
And now, The Coiled Spring is very proud to present a special preview of The Seance by Kristen McGorry, starring Kristen McGorry as Harry Houdini and Matthew Petty as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
How have you been, my friend? Your Australian tour not too taxing, I hope.
There were some ups and downs over there. As a country, it is very backward, but the audience made it all worthwhile. I was humbled by their acquiescence and sympathy, and the large amount of interest for my mission. However, I found the press less open-minded.
Many journalists seem to believe that we celebrities have become little different from their enemy. But the people were welcoming?
Oh, they are a dear folk, those Australians. Kind, hospitable, straight-talking. But Lord, do they need spiritualism, if for nothing more than to dynamite them out of their primitive grooves of thought.
And you were the man to do it.
I will send you a copy of my book when it's finished, The Wanderings of a Spiritualist. I hope you will see it as a worthy addition to your library.
So how were your seats at the theatre? I chose the best, centre stalls, close enough to see the action, not too near to detect the artifice behind the illusion.
You have fooled me in front of my very nose, my friend. But the seats were wonderful and your display astounding. The audience was sincerely appreciative. Cheer after cheer broke out from your rapturous spectators.
To say the applause was deafening is putting it mildly.
Well deserved. I heard you visited Davenport.
I did.
And?
I'm not sure.
You should not hold back for fear of my feelings, Harry. I'm a scientist, first and foremost.
Then I found the so-called mediums, of whom the public have heard much, to be nothing more than arrant impostors. Impostors who have taken advantage of the public's demand for spiritualistic excitement to fill their purses with easily earned dollars.
You caught them in a fraud?
Well, I secured a confession. From Ira himself. He maintains, though, that he and his brother had never claimed spiritualism to their audiences, that they just had ability and sufficient skill and misdirection, together with overwhelming energy and nerve to bamboozle.
Truth is mighty and must prevail. The papers are calling you the greatest medium baiter of modern times.
The paranormal movement has become a great stampede, and I will not be left behind in the rush.
I see.
Our views have always differed, my friend. We do not believe the same thing. You treat spiritualism as a religion.
While you are determined to treat it as a deception. Spiritualism is not merely a study of a force outside the rules of science. It is something tremendous, a breaking down of the walls between two worlds. A direct, undeniable message from the beyond. A call of hope and of guidance to the human race at the time of our deepest affliction.
It is true that after a generation of death, there is great comfort to be had in your beliefs.
And what of your business ventures?
I have been finishing off my new photoplay, Haldane of the Secret Service.
Another motion picture to demonstrate your unique talents.
In this one, I play the son of a murdered police official who tracks down a vicious gang of counterfeiters while narrowly missing death several times, of course.
Of course.
Another drink, Sir Arthur.
No, thank you. I want all my faculties about me for our session tonight. I must admit, I am eager to meet our medium.
Miss Fox. Yes, indeed.
I heard great things about her seances in London. The Society for Psychical Research found her to be a most interesting case.
They proclaimed her genuine.
I believe she is. Her hit rate was far beyond that which could be accounted for by guesswork and coincidence.
Then I'm desirous to see her display. I would dearly like to find an honest medium.
I have introduced you to many before, my friend, but you always seem determined to discredit them.
They need no help from me, Sir Arthur. Nothing would make me happier than to find incontrovertible proof of life after death. Losing my darling mamma was such a blow that the thought she is waiting for me on the other side is my deepest desire. But these mediums, can you honestly, hand on heart, say that you have ever met one who does not resort to manipulation and trickery? when the power does not manifest itself.
Hand on heart, I can. I have heard bells ring by spirit hands, seen tables move of their own volition.
It is amazing how often people accept paranormal phenomena as truth, quite forgetting to apply the laws of physics that govern their daily actions.
In your public performances, you do things which cannot be explained by the laws of nature. You seem to possess some kind of miraculous dematerializing power, allowing you to pass through solid objects and then reassemble on the other side. Is it so hard to believe that our medium possesses an equally divine power?
I never claim spiritualistic or supernatural aid. I inform the public that all my tricks are accomplished by natural means or, as you suggest, by art and practice. The mystery is how I did it. I'm a magician, not a miracle.
You are a magnificent actor, that is true. But you should not call yourself a magician. That title is beneath a man of your talent.
Sir Arthur, I long ago realised the seriousness of toying with the occult. People's willingness to believe is a powerful, dangerous drug, and there is a dark and dirty profit to be made in it.
We agree there.
So now I seek to unmask those who manipulate the vulnerable and weak with empty shows of relatives produced on cue and grave platitude.
I see you know a great deal on the negative side of spiritualism. I can only hope that more on the positive side will come your way tonight. It wants to be approached not in the spirit of a detective, but in that of a humble religious soul, yearning for hope and comfort.
Oh, well. On the subject of detectives, I always find it interesting, Sir Arthur, that your great creation, Holmes, is such a materialist and sceptic, and you such a believer.
Unlike most writers, I do not simply write myself into my stories. As I told the Times, please grip this fact with your cerebral tentacle, the doll and its maker are never identical.
A wonderful epithet.
My dear fellow, I really dislike sparring with a friend, so let's not continue. On the matter of being a sceptic, I am a healthy one. However, I never think of the possibility that those I am brought into contact with are trying to deceive me. That these people are deliberately misleading and disseminating for profit is inconceivable. But if I were to ever come across one of these human hyenas, I would denounce them as strongly as you.
For my part, I promise to enter into this experiment tonight with my mind absolutely clear and open. Furthermore, I will put no obstruction of any nature in the medium's way, assisting in all means in my power to obtain results.
Thank you, my friend. Just don't neglect the truths you have already had, for evil lies that way. Well, let's get some details out of the way. When and where can we see this play? That's another epithet, actually.
When and where? Let's get some details out of the way.
Yes.
So, when is the 21st to the 26th of March, mm-hmm. 2013?
Yes.
So I better write the end, because we're quite close to that.
Is it one of those, like, where the cast don't know... obviously the cast don't know the ending, but...
Yes, I don't know the ending.
Well, even better. I mean, is it going to be one of those... There's several endings and you're not going to tell them yet until the end?
Well, so interestingly, I'm toying with the idea of there being an element of a real haunting in the play. So, yes, potentially the ending is going to be very interesting. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be that the whole don't tell anybody the ending after you've seen it.
Oh, great, yes.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yes.
So, where is it going to be performed?
It's going to be performed at the Wimbledon Studio Theatre.
Oh, yes.
Yes. That old chestnut.
That old chestnut. And in fact, there was a haunting there, I believe. There was an incident. During the get-in, and for those of you not in the know, the get-in is when...
You get in.
You get into the theatre, because a lot of theatre companies don't have their own premises, so you have to... on the day before or a couple of days before you start the play itself, you have a big communal work day of carrying all your stuff in and getting it all set up. And it's lots of fun.
It is. We always have pizza.
There's pizza for breakfast.
Crying and recriminations.
There's always recriminations and yeah. And I remember there was an incident where a door slammed. And when someone turned round, there was no one there. So it must have been a ghost.
Must have been a ghost. There is no other logical or physical explanation in the laws of physics.
And there are other... Well, there's the, well, I mean, obviously, on the Saturday night performance at the Wimbledon Studio Theatre, there is a rhythmic thumping that sometimes manifests.
Yes.
Usually when the bar downstairs has its music playing.
The spirits are in force.
Flowing downstairs.
Yes. And then, obviously, there's Weird Wednesday, you know, Weird Wednesday, which is that every performance on Wednesday, the audience are weird.
Yes.
So don't come on a Wednesday. Or if you are weird, come on a Wednesday.
That's true.
That's the night to come.
And then there's also the snoring man of Wimbledon Studio Theatre. I think he's manifested himself several times, I think, on the matinees.
The director, isn't it?
No, that's a sort of a gaunt figure that sometimes drifts about front
aimlessly.
And backstage, aimlessly weeping and crying.
Yes.
With no fingernails.
Yes, it's a terrifying vision.
Luckily, however, they usually disappear within about...
Well, you know, Carl, I mean, actors are... Talking of which, actors are incredibly superstitious bunch. I mean, I literally... And I'm perverse in that way. And you know, I quite often go downstairs and start saying Macbeth and whistling Macbeth.
Macbeth. Is that the theme tune from Macbeth? Tune from Macbeth? Is it the same?
Scottish.
It's like a gay gavotte, isn't it?
Gay gavotte, yes.
Is it a gavotte? Is that
bagpipes.
A Scottish thing? Yeah, bagpipe dance with the swords.
With the swords.
Not really Macbethy, really.
No, I seem to remember there's a lot more death in Macbeth. Death in Macbeth. Not so much jumping on swords. Or over swords.
But, the new!
Yes, I mean, so, you know, there's people in the group that won't, like, if you say good luck to them, it's...
They punch you in the face.
It's tantamount to saying, I hope you die on stage. There's the Scottish play, whistling...
I mean, of course, bearing in mind that there are people that, no matter what you say to them, they'll probably die on stage.
Yes. Ooh. Yes.
Bitchy Matthew. Not naming any names because I can't actually think of any, and it's
No, but then you know some, and some people have got more harmless sort of superstitions. But it is amazing. I mean, you might think that you're the most rational person ever, but when it comes to performing, and you know, it's such a tense thing, and it's such a you're not really, as an amateur, I don't think you're ever really in control of it because you're not trained.
No, that's
so,
right.
So you could be affected by having a bad day at work and then going on stage in the evening or, you know, so every little thing, it's like, oh, I must have my can of Red Bull, or if I, you know, if I don't have my sort of my bun tonight, it's going to go badly. Or
well, my previous guest, Robin Deacon, we talked about in his performances, and we talked about how we've both performed over the years, and how we treat or approach the whole uncertainty thing and dealing with errors and problems how there are fundamentally different ways of approaching that. And I think, of course, with a performance art piece, which is what Robin does, it doesn't matter so much because, I mean, that's not to do down performance art, but because you're not trying to stick to the script.
Yes.
You might have more freedom within the stuff that you've prepared for yourself. Whereas with this, of course, and in a group performance as well, you're supporting everybody else. You can't
exactly
go off on your own, and because again,
you can't go rogue.
You can't go rogue, especially because again, as you say, we're amateurs and we're not trained to deal with someone who's gone rogue, apart from to stand with our mouths open.
Yes.
In horror, terrified. It's like, what? Oh shit!
Yes.
What do we do?
Exactly. Although with this play, I mean, obviously from the extract that we read,
yes,
the more eagle-eared, is that even a thing?
Yes.
The more eagle-eared of your listeners will have heard that I quite like words, and that those passages were quite verbose. Well, some of them obviously were taken from actual real letters.
From real source material.
Real source martinis. Oh, yummy.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually.
And you know, some of it is the fact that I just love kind of wordplay, and but what I'm also planning to do with the play is have some improv in it.
Oh.
Yes. So yeah, there's going to be obviously with the, you know, interacting with the audience, there's going to be improv. The cold reading, there's going to be improv.
Yes. Yes.
And then when something unexpected happens in the interval, there's going to be some improv.
Oh, that's a big teaser.
I know. Do you like that?
I do like it. So, I mean, is it perhaps something to do with the perhaps supernatural nature of the play?
It could be something to do with the supernatural nature of the play, yes.
Interesting.
There's no point telling a story about a séance without having a few ghosts thrown in for good measure.
So that's our show. Thank you very much, Kristen, for your time. Thanks for coming back.
It's been my pleasure, and thanks for the lasagna.
Oh, you're welcome. It was very good. I think you'll agree. So just to recap, The Seance by Kristen McGorry.
Yes.
Performed by the Carlton Dramatic Society.
Yes, from the 21st to the 26th of May 2013.
May. Oh, I thought you said March before.
Did I?
Okay. May.
It's definitely May.
It's
definitely
21st May. To the 26th of May.
May.
2013.
Yes.
Wimbledon Studio Theatre.
Yes.
Wimbledon.
Wimbledon.
London-ish.
The world.
The earth. England. Europe.
Europe. Yeah, well, that's kind of in the wrong order there.
Yeah.
But
universe.
The universe,
galaxy.
Yes. Yes.
And, yeah.
Come and see it.
Tickets are not on sale yet.
No, probably not. But yeah, no, come and see it. It's going to be, I promise it's going to be an exciting and interesting theatrical experience.
And it will also be informative as well as being entertaining.
Absolutely, yes. The triumvirate of, well, that's only two things, but informative, entertaining and exciting.
Yes, there you go.
The triumvirate of drama.
Yes.
And it's the world premiere
The world premiere of a brand new original play.
Yes.
From an upcoming new playwright in the southeast of England.
Yes.
So, well, thank you very much, Kristen.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Coiled Spring was created, edited and presented by Matthew Petty and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike license. Music is by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com, and you can send suggestions, comments, requests and demands to feedback@coiledspring.org. Thanks for listening.
Scene.